Feel free to get organized. We're ready to begin when you are, Council for Appellant.
Good morning. Pat Turnan with the law firm of Collins, Buckley, Santry, and Hulk in St. Paul, and I appear for the appellants, Robert and John Nockshing. Your Honors, we're here on the appeal of an order granting a summary judgment to Liberty Mutual Insurance Company in a garnishment action that followed a Miller-Shugart settlement. The underlying action was a defamation claim. Liberty Mutual insured was Norm Wortnick. The claim against him was that he was involved in procuring the publication of a book that included defamatory statements. There are two issues. First issue is whether there is coverage under the Liberty Mutual excess policy. The district court ruled that the policy generally provided coverage for defamation claims, but that the business pursuit exclusion excluded coverage under the facts of this case. In reviewing an order granting a summary judgment, this court determines whether there are material facts in issue and whether the trial court erred on the legal issues. There was a question in the respondent's brief suggesting that the standard of review might be different because there had been stipulated facts or a court trial. That's not true. I read from the district court decision on page 6. If genuine issues of material fact exist, the parties' cross motions for summary judgment will not obviate the need for a trial on the factual questions. So this is no different than any other summary judgment case presented to the court. What is unique in this case involving an insurance policy, the burden of proof on the exclusion, of course, is on the insured, and the exclusion is construed strictly against the insurance company. Burden of proof is on the insurer. The exclusion is construed strictly against the insurance company. The legal standard in Minnesota on the business pursuit exclusion is well established. We adopt a two-pronged definition of business pursuits. To be a business pursuit, there must be both continuity and profit motive. Continuity being defined as a continued or regular activity for the purpose of earning a livelihood or gain. Profit motive being defined as a showing that the activity is undertaken for monetary gain. Applied to the facts in this case, Norm Wortnick was a 77-year-old retired florist. He had never been involved in writing or publishing any books. He had been approached by his brother, Jack Wortnick, suggesting that they try to find an author to write a book telling Norm's story. And the court is aware there's a long history of this case, very long history dating back 40 years. This is many decades after the last action. His brother decides there should be a book written telling Norm's side of the story.
Mr. Cheney, one thing that seems to distinguish this coverage issue from some of the cases that you cited is, in this case, we actually have a specific definition of business pursuit in the policy. And some of the cases don't. Would you agree with that?
No, I don't. Okay. The other cases do cite the exclusionary language in the policies. The Askrid case, I think it's cited. I've got the cases here. The Patch case does cite the language. Depositors cites the language that they're involved with. The language is a little different.
Right.
Okay, in this case.
I mean, here our language is any activities of a business, trade, occupation, or profession except the providing of professional services.
Right. And the other cases and the distinction that they make is that there's another clause on the end of that exclusion in the other cases that talks about, unless it's otherwise, a personal activity. But that other clause does not come into play in any in Askrid, in Patch, or in depositors. It doesn't come into play. All those cases are decided on the definition of business pursuit, not on the exclusion contained within that definition in the other cases.
Well, here, we've read your brief and so forth, but just to try to really focus your argument, here the district court did a fairly, I thought, thorough job of looking at the facts here with respect to the involvement that Norman Wortnick had with respect to this book and its procurement and, financing and so forth.
I disagree again. Your Honor, the district court relied on the trial court's definition of facts. But in that definition of facts, what the district court did is it looked at the LLC, okay? It did not look at the insured, Norm Wortnick. Norm Wortnick did nothing under the facts in this case.
Well, I mean, he talks about he contributed $4,000.
He contributed $4,000.
He had a position. On the board. They had periodic meetings, apparently.
Annual meetings where the book was sometimes discussed. Mm-hmm. That's what's in, and that's it. He didn't review the book. He didn't propose edits to the book. Mm-hmm. He was not involved in any of the marketing that the district court talks about.
But it was a for-profit corporation.
It was a for-profit corporation. That's true. But the test is whether the insured in this case engaged in that activity for the purpose of gainful employment, for the profit motive. The only testimony in this case is that he engaged in the activity to clear his name, that he was not involved in it for any profit motive or any form of employment. It is not, it doesn't need to be part of his normal employment, but it was not.
Yeah, I don't think the employment, you would agree, is not essential to
it. It's certainly not critical. It's a factor that's looked at in the positors. This court looked at it as a factor, noted that in both of the prior Askrud and Parch cases, it was not part of their normal gainful employment. It is a factor to be looked at. I mean, the test is whether it's part of a continued or regular activity for the purpose of earning a livelihood. Norm Wortnick did nothing here. He did not engage in any regular activity other than he was part of the LLC, he attended annual meetings, and he made a $4,000 contribution. That's it, and that's the extent of his involvement.
Would that not satisfy the description, the definition of business pursuits?
Because you've got to show that the activity is undertaken for a monetary gain or for personal gain, and that the activity is a continued or regular activity for the purpose of earning a livelihood or gain. Attending a meeting once a year is not an activity to earn a livelihood or financial gain. That's not why he's doing it. That's not his motive. That's not his purpose. And this is what the district court did. It expanded and looked at the entire LLC. But the insured in this case is Norm Wortnick, 77 years old, not involved in anything to earn money or to gain or for financial gain. His sole and exclusive purpose, based on the testimony, was his desire to clear his name and his brother's desire to clear his name. He didn't involve himself in any continued activity. He attended an annual meeting. All he did. That doesn't satisfy the definition under the cases we cite in our brief.
How does that relate to, and maybe I'm misremembering this, so correct me if I'm wrong, but he doesn't have a direct, there's not a defamation claim against him. Well, is the conduct at issue his publication of the book, his participation in publishing versus defamation?
It's a defamation claim. Under the Restatement of Torts, Section 577, Comment F, okay, anyone involved in procuring the publication of a defamatory statement is responsible for the statement. I agree with you that he did not, quote, unquote, make the statements in the book. Mm-hmm. That's true. But anybody involved in procuring the publication of defamatory statements is responsible, and that's a direct liability claim for their publication. That was the primary claim against Norm Wortnick. The trial court also discussed the vicarious liability claim. We never asserted that in our complaint, but the trial court found that there was both a direct and vicarious liability claim remaining against Norm Wortnick. So it is true, he did not specifically make the statements, but his involvement in defamation law is anybody who procures the publication of a defamatory statement is responsible.
And you would argue that that procurement was for a personal name-clearing purpose?
Well, without question. At the time it was, quote, procured, there was no LLC. The LLC is not formed until 18 months after they select Hunt to write the book, until after a draft of the book had been written. And in the testimony of Norm Wortnick, the LLC was formed for the purpose of limiting liability, not for gain, but for limiting liability. I don't view the LLC as having much relevance on the factors that were certainly relevance, but not as having significant relevance on the factors we're talking about. There's always going to be some agreement that if there's money coming in, it's going to be divided in a certain way, but that's not his motive or purpose. And the fact that they formed an LLC, I think the motivating factor in forming the LLC was clearly the limitation of liability, not the distribution of money that might come in.
And your argument that purpose, his purpose, is not a, there's no genuine issue of material fact about his purpose. You're not asking for a trial or not. You're saying his purpose is clearly
there's
established.
No question. Okay. The only testimony in the record is that his purpose was to clear his name, that Jack Wartnick's purpose was to clear Norm Wartnick's name. There's no question that's how this started. There's no question that that's what the state of the evidence is and that that's how this all started and that that's why Hunt was procured as the author 18 months before the LLC was ever formed. Those facts are not disputed. Your Honor, let me move on to the second issue then.
Sure.
The second issue is whether the $695,000 Miller-Shugart settlement was reasonable and prudent. The legal standard, the plaintiff has the burden of proof on showing that it's reasonable and prudent. The most significant decision we have is the Jorgensen Supreme Court decision that says we consider what a jury could have awarded and all other relevant factors. The district court in this case, and I by and large agree with the district court, it said on this point that what you focus on is the nature of the defamatory content and the scale of communication. Now, the nature of the defamatory content, we would argue, cannot be more damaging than it was. The Knox Humes have been accused of murdering their father by the person that a jury had found responsible for that murder.
It did seem like the district court focused more on the marketing effort and the level of circulation of the book.
Well, it did, and I would suggest that that focus should have been just the opposite. Certainly in my experience, which may be different than the district court, the focus is on the defamatory communication. If you look at the cases we cite, and they're all different because they're all factually dependent. You can always distinguish the facts on these defamation cases. The injury is the emotional harm, the mental harm caused to the specific plaintiff in that case, and everybody is different. The harm is different for every person. But the nature of the defamatory statement is certainly the most compelling factor. If you accuse somebody of murdering their father or some other egregious conduct like that, it's pretty significant. And I think the proof of that in this case, that in the wrongful death action tried in the early 1980s, I think, the verdict was $2.3 million or something in that neighborhood for the death. And then the malpractice action verdict is over $4 million. There's only a single-line special verdict form. There's no breakdown as to how the jury came up with that $4-plus million. But the prior verdict—
How do those numbers bear upon this determination?
Well, I think it shows what a jury could do because you're talking about the emotional part being the identical injury. Norm Wartnick's complaint in that malpractice action was twofold. He had a deal with this verdict, which was $2.3 million, and he had suffered emotionally from being labeled a murderer. What the jury found is, you know, in addition to the prior jury verdict, they awarded him $1.7 million, $1.695 million, and that is for being accused, for the damage of being caused by being accused of murdering Robert Knockstein. Now, you apply that to this case, that's 30 years ago, so the damage number would be higher, and the accusation of being accused of murdering your own father by the person who did it is a more serious accusation. We would say that's a measure of what a jury could award in a case like this. And that's why we think it's highly relevant, the amount. Now, to be fair, the trial judge after that case reduced the verdict because you can't recover those emotional injuries in that malpractice action. They're not compensable. At least there was a debate about it at that time. So that verdict was reduced. But that's what the claim was about, and that's what the jury did award at that time. The other factor that we think is compelling in this case on the Miller-Shugart is that it's entered into 3 days before trial was to commence. This Norm Wartnick at the time is represented by a different lawyer, not the lawyer here, but by a Liberty Mutual employee lawyer who had just not attended a court-ordered mediation, had not brought her client to that mediation when she had been ordered to, and was now looking at a trial where he was the only defendant, where the evidence that we intended to show was that he was responsible for the murder that he accused my clients of. That's a pretty compelling fact situation for him to be confronted with. And when you consider all of the factors on a Miller-Shugart, that is, I think, a significant factor, that he was looking at a jury trial with Liberty Mutual having made no offer of settlement, with a Liberty Mutual attorney about to defend him, with Liberty Mutual denying coverage, and with him confronting the potential of an excess verdict, we would argue.
Well, so that, you know, does in some ways support the district court's statement that this was not an arm's length agreement. I mean, it, you know, it's an agreement that contains language that's intended to speak to the coverage of this claim.
I think it is. It does include that language. That is an issue that the court has reserved ruling on. If this goes back to the district court, they've asked for an evidentiary ruling on that.
But the point I'm trying to make is, you know, this is he's. He's clearly operating without his own counsel's advice. He's, you know, hearing things from his brother's attorney, apparently.
That's true.
And, you know, so he's willing to sign whatever is placed in front of him if it eliminates his own personal liability.
Well, I think you can make that argument. You can make that argument, of course, in any Miller-Shugart case. I think in this case, if you're considering the context of the settlement, that's a factor. Not a factor that we think it weighs against them as much as it weighs against us. They waited till the last minute to have this happen. Their insured is going to be under greater pressure. Their insured is going to need to find a way out of it more. I think it weighs as much against them as against us. But again, that's an issue that the trial court has reserved. If this case goes back, they've asked for an evidentiary hearing on that issue. And we think, of course, it weighs in our favor.
Thank you, Mr. Tierney. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stephen Warner. I represent respondent Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. We're asking this court to affirm the judgment in favor of Liberty Mutual in all respects. The district court did correctly conclude that the Liberty Mutual policies provided no coverage. I don't think there's any dispute here that the homeowner's policy provided no coverage. They haven't taken that position. But the court also correctly concluded that the excess policy provided no coverage because of the business pursuits exclusion. And in addition, for reasons that I'll hopefully have a chance to discuss in more detail, the district court properly concluded that the settlement amount was unreasonable. On coverage, Judge Hallbrooks, I think you identified the key issue here. What does the policy say in terms of the definition of business pursuits? And here, business pursuits are defined as any activities of a business, trade, occupation, or profession. Counsel's suggestion on behalf of the appellants that the exclusion only applies to activities that are in furtherance of a livelihood. It's belied by both the applicable law and by policy language. As far as the law is concerned, the Askerud Court made it pretty clear that business pursuits include activities undertaken as your livelihood and activities undertaken for gain. Two different things. In the Smith case, which is cited in our briefing, this court specifically held that a side business storing boats was a business pursuit, even though the insured's livelihood was as a financial analyst. So there's no question that it's financial gain that matters.
Can you speak to the argument? So as I understand the argument, it's that at the time that they procured this, the author, I guess, there's no question that the purpose was to clear his name, and that the LLC wasn't entered into until many months later. What's wrong with that argument in terms of the you know, whether it was a business pursuit at the time, and if that's the foundation for the claim?
Well, first and foremost, I would submit that the first draft of the book, which was a work of fiction, actually, not a true crime book that it ended up being, nobody's claiming that version of the book contained any defamatory statements or anything like that. It's completely irrelevant. The book that was produced as a function of a commercial enterprise. And so what happened before the formation of the LLC, I would submit, is irrelevant. That book, nobody claims it contained any defamatory statements, and it never saw the light of day. It was never published. It's an irrelevancy. So what evidence do we have of profit motive? The evidence is in the bylaws and the member control agreement of the LLC. Nobody held a gun to Mr. Wartnick's head and told him he had to form an LLC. He formed it. There's evidence here certainly suggests that he formed it willingly, volitionally. He signed the bylaws and the member control agreement, and what do those say? The bylaws say this is a business. It's a for-profit business. Bylaws don't say that, but it is. It's formed under a specific statutory scheme that applies only to for-profit businesses. The business purpose is the creation and publication of the book, and under the member control agreement, Norman Wartnick, like the other members of the LLC, stood to profit if the business made money. It was a for-profit enterprise. He entered into it. He formed the business. The business existed because of him and his cohorts.
Mr. Tierney argues that the focus should not be on the LLC. It should be on specifically Mr. Wartnick and his involvement.
Well, and I would submit, Your Honor, that the focus has to be on the LLC because Mr. Wartnick was one of three people who formed it. That is evidence of his business intention with respect to creation of this book.
But what if that occurred after the book was created? Like, even if we took your argument that that book on which the defamatory statements actually appeared was later, was that prior to the LLC? And when, like, I don't know when that book was actually completed relative to the start of the LLC, and why do we need to focus only on the LLC?
The LLC was formed in 2008. The book was published in 2013. The book went through a number of revisions, mostly based on input, or almost exclusively based on input from Jack Wartnick. It's important to focus on the LLC, I would submit, because the book that ended up being published, which contains the allegedly defamatory statements, was created as a function of that business. That business's only business purpose was creation of the book, and Mr. Wartnick was one of the three members of that business. His protestations to the contrary, he formed the business to create the book. The business had a profit-making intention. It was a for-profit corporation. They hired marketing people to market the book. They did marketing events. All of that was done for the betterment of the three members of the LLC, including Norman Wartnick. The other reason the LLC is important is because, as Mr. Tierney has pointed out, Norman Wartnick's only involvement with the book that ended up being published was in the context of the business. The only thing he did related to this book was attend annual meetings required by the LLC's bylaws and member control agreement. He did nothing else related to this book. His only involvement with the book was as a function of the requirements of this LLC, a business purpose. And he did it continually. For 5 years, he attended annual meetings. Continuity doesn't require daily involvement. It requires continuous involvement, which Mr. Wartnick clearly had. There's no dispute that he attended these annual meetings every year. And it's also undisputed that he did nothing else and related to the book. Nothing personal, no personal involvement in the book, only business involvement in the creation of this book.
Well, he did give Hunt access to his legal files, correct?
Right.
Yes, from the underlying matter. Yeah.
That's true. Mm-hmm. That's true. It also bears pointing out that if, as Mr. Tierney suggests, Norman Wartnick had nothing to do with the content of the book, he wouldn't have any liability for defamation on any theory anyway. I mean, if he's as uninvolved as we think he was, and as Mr. Tierney is representing to the court here that he was, he didn't have any liability for defamation anyway. But that's more relative to the reasonableness of the settlement than to the coverage question. So here are the undisputed facts. And one other point I would make about the policy language. The definition of business pursuit says business, trade, occupation, or profession. Business has to mean something other than your occupation, trade, or profession. Otherwise, the word business is superfluous in the policy, which, of course, under rules of insurance policy construction, we have to look for an interpretation of the policy that gives effect to all of its terms. So any suggestion that the business has to be a trade or a livelihood, you know, that a 77-year-old guy who's otherwise retired can't be involved in a business pursuit is belied by the policy language itself. So what are the facts here? As I said, Norm Ortnick formed the business. The business purpose was creation of this book. It's a for-profit enterprise. Mr. Ortnick served as vice president, chief financial manager, and the treasurer of the business, whose purpose was creation of this book. If the book sold, he stood to profit from it. And all of his book-related activities were in the context of the business.
Can I turn your attentions to the reasonableness of the settlement?
Yes.
You obviously heard appellant's argument and talks about the verdicts that were obtained in both the wrongful death and then the legal malpractice action. There are other, of course, defamation verdicts that the district court goes through, and I'm sure were brought to the district court's attention by the parties.
Yes.
So I just want to open up the floor to you.
Thank you. First and foremost, with regard to the wrongful death verdict, that verdict was for wrongful death, a measure of damages completely unrelated to defamation, pecuniary loss from the death of the decedent. That's irrelevant.
I think it's just the difference that he's talking about is relevant.
Yep.
Right?
Yes, probably. The legal malpractice verdict, I would submit, has nothing to do with the case as well. Mr. Tierney is extrapolating things from that verdict that I think are not necessarily accurately reflected in the facts of that case or the verdict. It's a $4 million verdict. Part of that, the damages in that case, were the $2.3 million wrongful death verdict. Another huge part of that was interest accrued over more than 10 years on a $2.3 million verdict. That brings you up to about, I think, $3.8 million. And the remainder of it, what the claim was, the remainder of it was for legal fees. Now, Mr. Ortnick did ask the court for leave to submit to the jury emotional damages. And the court specifically rejected that request. The jury was not asked to decide anything about emotional damages. Post-trial, the court rejected Mr. Ortnick's suggestion that the jury had awarded damages for emotional distress. So the legal malpractice verdict was, again, a verdict that was consistent with the damages that are properly awarded in such a case. Underlying verdict in the case within the case, interest accrued on the case within the case. I don't understand why the court didn't award legal expenses from the prior representation.
Is that what got knocked down?
That's my understanding. But one way or the other, emotional damages were not part of that case by fiat of the district court, who precluded those damages from being submitted. So I would submit that
take
verdict
those out.
Is out as well, which leaves us with two things: the nature of the allegedly defamatory statements, which are admittedly as about as bad as you can get, and the scope of the publication of those allegedly defamatory statements. And the problem I would submit with the plaintiff's damages claim at $695,000. As reflected in the Miller-Shugart settlement, is that the evidence in this case indicates that about 10 people, other than Tried and True LLC itself, bought the book. Tried and True bought 600 copies. The only other people we know of who bought copies of this book were a couple of relatives of the Knocksheims, who indicated in affidavits that they didn't believe what was in the book anyway, and a couple judges in other countries. No other purchases of the book. It wasn't that good of a book.
Is there anything in the record about what happened to those 600 that were purchased by Triumph?
There is nothing. And so, unlike some of the verdicts that the Nachsheim submitted to the district court, we have an extremely limited scope of publication of the statements contained in the book. That, I would submit, makes this case significantly different from the two cases that were cited where a jury awarded more than the $695,000 that was stipulated to in this case. You know, a tree fell in the forest. Defamatory statements allegedly were made. If very few people read them, the damage to reputation is certainly much more circumscribed than in a circumstance where you have a media outlet broadcasting on TV or in a newspaper to millions of people or hundreds of thousands. That's just not what happened in this case. The court also, I think I would submit, properly considered the fact that the settlement with Jack Wortnick was only for $75,000. Mr. Wortnick...
Of course, that was an issue as to whether or not that should have been considered by the district court.
It was.
Yeah.
You've heard from appellant's counsel, Jack Wortnick was a moving force behind this book. Jack Wortnick had most of the involvement in editing and making suggestions about the content of the book. Jack Wortnick spearheaded marketing efforts for the book. There was nothing other than a $75,000 monetary settlement that went into the settlement agreement with Jack Wortnick, contrary to what counsel has indicated. If you look at the settlement agreement itself, it's for $75,000. It has a clause in it that says what's in the contract or in the agreement was all the entire agreement. Mr. Jack Wortnick had a lot more potential exposure for procuring publication of the book than did Norman Wortnick, which I would submit makes the $75,000 settlement he entered into much more relevant than is suggested by the other side. And finally, one last point. My read of the district court's decisions on summary judgment in the underlying case is that the only claim that remained against Norman Wortnick was a vicarious liability claim. Even under the restatement, what the restatement says is if you get somebody else to publish something, you're vicariously liable for any defamation. The Nachsheim settled with the directly liable party, the author of the book. No question about that, again, notwithstanding their statements to the contrary. It's in the Miller-Shugart agreement itself, paragraph 8. Says, we have settled with every other party to this case other than Norman Wortnick. If you extinguish the liability of the directly liable party, the liability of a vicarious liable party is also extinguished. That's what happened in this case. Mr. Wortnick had no exposure, and therefore the settlement amount was unreasonable. We ask for affirmance of all on all counts.
Thank you, Mr. Warner. Mr. Tierney?
Just follow up with the last comment counsel made. Yes, the settlement agreement says that we've reached agreement with the other parties. The agreement with the other parties is that if we could not get an agreement with Norm Wortnick, there'd be a dismissal of the LLC, not a release. There's a difference. And we were well aware of the concept that he's talking about at the time of it, was why we kind of danced around the issue. The bottom line is that's an issue, again, that the trial court has reserved for its consideration if it goes back to the trial court. But clearly there's no release signed until many, many months, no release signed by the other defendants until many, many months after the Miller-Shugart was entered into. And that was done for a reason to avoid the identical argument that counsel raises now. Let me talk about the scope of the publication, because that is what Your Honor pointed out was the district court's primary factor in its consideration was the scope of the publication. There's both a quantity and a quality element to the scope of the publication. Nachsheims don't care what people down in Georgia may have read about them. The focus on publication is not the number of different people that have read it, but who has read it. In this case, what we know is that the Wortnicks, Jack Wortnick, the LLC, acquired 700 copies of the book. We do know from the district court's decision that Jack Wortnick handed those out for free. They're not sold, I agree with that. They're distributed by Jack Wortnick. We don't have the numbers. They could not produce the numbers. We don't know the exact number of sales. We don't know how many were handed out, but what the district court order in this case says is that Jack Wortnick distributed those. They had open houses at Jack Wortnick's. They had legal seminars where they'd hand the books out. We know that there's 700. We don't know if 700 have been distributed or 500, but that's where the damage lies. The Nakshims don't know who read the book. The injury is a mental injury from not knowing whether the person they meet in the grocery store has read that book or not, whether their friends from back in high school have read it or not. We know that it's distributed to as many as 700 people within the community that knows about the history of this case, the people that went to Jack Wortnick's house, the people that went to the legal seminars on this, that were familiar with the background of this case. Up to 700 copies were distributed. Whether it's 700 or 300 or 500, we don't know. But in Robert Nakshim's mind, he doesn't know if all 700 of those people have read it or not. He doesn't know when he runs into these people years later, high school classmates, whether they read the book or not. They don't say anything, but if he sees them looking kind of funny at him, in his mind, and this is where the injury is, in his mind, he doesn't know how many people have read it. So it's the quality of the publication, not just the quantity. Whether 5 million people have read it or not, it doesn't matter. If the 100 people closest to him have read it, that is where the injury lies. Whether somebody in Europe read it or not, it doesn't matter. So the district court, we believe, has it right on the nature of the defamatory statement as being very significant, and on the publication certainly being significant, but not necessarily the quantity of publication. It's the quality.
Is there specific authority for that?
No, nor is there any specific authority for what the trial court has found. No, there's no authority on that at all. All you can do is look at the cases.
But when you look at the cases, I'm looking at the ones in the stipulation. I mean, would you agree that these verdicts were the result of much broader circulation and marketing?
No. Some yes, some no. Take the Ledoux case, mm-hmm. A single editorial printed in the Duluth News Tribune, editorial on the editorial page in the Duluth News Tribune, certainly a wide circulation, but $796,000 in compensatory damage is all compensatory. I think it's for arranging to have somebody pave his driveway. He's the head of the Public Works Department. It's a lot of money for that kind of an injury. Is it focused more on the injury or the circulation? I don't know, but then you look at the Susan Anderson case, $1 million verdict. She lives in Hudson, Wisconsin. The publication is by a Twin Cities TV station. It reaches Wisconsin to some extent, but not that much. So the publication where she lives was not that significant. It was published in the Twin Cities, but not that significant. We think the focus there is more on what was said. They accused her of a type of a malpractice. The Stoffrent case, there's a $150,000 roughly damage award. That's a guy who only two or three people had heard of the defamatory statement. This is a guy who worked for American Family, was fired. His supervisor starts telling the legal community that hinted that he did some inappropriate things, but we could only identify two people that statement was actually made to. That's $150,000 roughly jury verdict. So it's not based on the extent of the publication. We think it's just unique. We think the focus is more on how each individual plaintiff has been affected by the publication. And it's more the quality. And Stoffrent, the quality of the publication was to people he knew directly. Anderson, the publication was to people she didn't know. So it's hard to say.
I appreciate your answer. Anything you'd like to say in summation?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tooney. Thank you, Mr. Warner. The case has been submitted. Marshall, could you call